Program is available at 367-0300. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about something that I think on and off on the program we certainly have discussed before in different ways, and that is green architecture, green design when it comes to building buildings. Not exactly a new idea. There have been people doing this for a while now, but mostly on a fairly small scale. And we'll be talking this morning with an internationally known architect who has been doing this and doing it on a rather large scale, something that, in fact, some people might be prepared to argue you just can't do. Our guest is Ken Yang, and he specializes in green architecture and, in fact, has done this and applied it to skyscrapers, big buildings. And he has pioneered a new kind of tall building, something that he calls the bioclimatic skyscraper. He's designed more than a dozen high-rise towers and over 200 projects worldwide. His firm is T.R. Hamza and Yang International, based in Kuala Lumpur, and has offices there and in London and in Beijing. The firm has won a number of awards for its work, recently completed the National Library in Singapore, and was awarded a Green Platinum Prize, which is the highest award for a green and sustainable building, an award that comes from the government of Singapore. It's also received several other international awards, including the Prince Claus Award and the Royal Australian Institute of Architects International Award. And in addition to dividing his time between London and Kuala Lumpur, he is also Distinguished Endowed Plan Professor in Architecture here at the University of Illinois, and it's spending time here with students working on projects. And we're pleased that he could come by and spend a little bit of time with us here on the program. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So either those numbers, 333-9455, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. He's also, I would like to mention, authored a number of books on this subject, including Designing with Nature, which was published in 1995, The Green Skyscraper in 2000, and a new one, Eco-Design Instruction Manual, that was published last year. Well, thank you for being here.
Oh, hello, David.
I appreciate it. How is it that now, and I know that you have been working in this area doing green design for several decades now, this must have been something that began to interest you at the point where you were still a student and still studying. What drew you into this area?
Oh, it was the topic for my PhD. And so when I finished the PhD, it became, my life's agenda. And never looked back since then.
What drew you to it in the first place, though, do you think?
By default.
It was just an accident?
No, it became a topic that I spent 4 years doing research on. So once you get involved with a topic, it's very difficult to extract yourself from it. And I felt it was an ethically important topic for me. And so I spent the rest of my life trying to explore it, extend it, develop the theory, and try and do as many green buildings as I can.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that to different people, the term green architecture might mean different things.
Yes.
People might think of the environmental impact of the building, its energy consumption, what it takes to build it, mm-hmm. how people live in it, all of those sorts of things. To you, when you use that term green design, green architecture, what do you mean?
Well, the term green actually has been used like a duffel coat. It covers a multitude of architectures. But for me, a green building is an ecologically responsive building. It's a building that integrates a human-made built environment with the natural environment in a seamless and benign way. Mm. Now, if we're able to integrate everything that we do as human beings, our activities and our built environment, with the natural environment in a seamless and benign way, then there wouldn't be any environmental problems at all. And so this is the biggest single challenge confronting us as ecological designers today, trying to successfully integrate what we make and build and do with the natural environment.
Yeah. And with this thing that you call the bioclimatic skyscraper, you're doing something very interesting, and it's more than just thinking ecologically and site selection, and it has more to do than how your site ends up being landscaped. You're actually trying to integrate the landscape into the building, make it part of the building.
Oh, no, that landscaping is something else altogether, which is part of green design. But bioclimatic design is essentially integrating, designing in response to the climate of the locality in which the building is located. Mm-hmm. So in this way, it is a passive mode design. That means the building uses less energy before you add in the mechanical electrical systems. So bioclimatic design is a subset of green design.
Mm. Can you describe what a bioclimatic skyscraper would look like?
Well, I can tell you how it performs first before how it looks like. Uh-huh. A skyscraper, let me start out right by saying a skyscraper isn't a particularly green building. A skyscraper is as ungreen as you can get, short being an atomic, a power station. Mm-hmm. And so a skyscraper uses probably one-third more energy and resources than would a low-rise or medium-rise building. Now, my contention and my belief is that a skyscraper is a built form. It's not a built form that's going to go away overnight. It exists for a number of reasons, and some of the reasons, is because of the high land value, and part of it is because of its, part of the consequence of urban growth. But if it's a built form that's not going to go away overnight, then my contention is that we should make them as green as possible. And that, if the best ecological designers in the world don't want to touch skyscrapers, then who will? And so, I tell people it's a dirty job designing skyscrapers. We should make them green as possible, but somebody has to do it. And so I spent a good part of my life looking into the idea of a green skyscraper and try and make them as green as possible. But not just as green as possible, but try and make them as humane as possible and as pleasurable for people to live in, to use as well.
Yeah, it certainly. I have read some things you've said about it. Certainly, your argument is that, particularly if you look at an increasing density of urban environments, if you're going to provide places for people to live and do it on a relatively small footprint, you don't have a whole lot of choice, really. You pretty much have to build up.
That's right.
Well, having said that, then, what are some of the kinds of ideas that you have used in designing this kind of building?
Well, I think a skyscraper cannot be regarded as an ordinary piece of an ordinary building, because it is an intensive building of intensification of square footage on a very small footprint. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at some of the skyscrapers in New York and Chicago, you have maybe 20, 30 acres of built-up space on a very small footprint. So when you look at a building that way, it's no longer a work of architecture. It is a work of urban design. So I see skyscraper design as not as designing a building or designing a work of architecture, but as vertical urban design. And so by this what I mean that anything that you find pleasurable in urban design in horizontal terms, if you flip it vertically, that's what exactly we should do in skyscraper design. We should try and, for instance, urban design has to do with creating public realm, and so we should try and look into creating public realm in the sky. Urban design has to do with landscaping, and so we should look into vertical landscaping. Urban design has to do with linkages, spaces between buildings. So we should look at creating spaces between usable spaces in the sky. And so, these are the set of ideas that I have on designing skyscrapers.
Mm-hmm. So just for an example, if one of the things that we like is the idea that we would like to have a public space that is open and airy and has things growing in it and a place where people can go and sit and just enjoy the sun, they can sit and have a picnic, they can have their coffee, their whatever, that if that's the kind of thing that we'd like to have on the ground, if we're going to build up, that there's no reason why we couldn't have that kind of a space as part of a tall building.
Absolutely no reason why I can't do that. So, there's no reason why we can't have schools in the sky. You already have prisons in the sky in New York. You have multi-story prisons. Okay. And so you could have plazas in the sky. We should have Starbucks in the sky. We should have the local news agent in the sky, the laundry in the sky. So instead of, having people could go all the way down to the ground to get access to these facilities and amenities, we should have them in the sky and accessible to people in the same way that you would have at a ground level.
Mm. Are your buildings primarily for housing, or are they office buildings, or are they, can they be some of both?
Well, I do everything. I do office, I do apartments, I do hotels, and I sometimes do mixed-use buildings, which have hotels, offices, and retail in the same tower. Hmm. And so, you know, all building types, all building users.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Ken Yang. He is a distinguished endowed PLIM professor in architecture here at University of Illinois, is involved in architecture firm T.R. Hamza & Yang International, which is based in Kuala Lumpur. They have offices there and also in London and in Beijing, and is well known for green architecture, particularly trying to apply those kinds of principles to big buildings, in fact, to skyscrapers. He's written books on this and has been working in this area for quite a while. 333-9455 is our Champaign-Urbana number. If you'd like to give us a call, if you have questions, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the problems that comes with a skyscraper, with that concentration of people, is energy consumption. They're very energy intensive mm-hmm. buildings, and you get that many people together. How do you approach that, and have you done some things to try to reduce the energy consumption of a building like this, tall building like this?
Well, an average high-rise building in Chicago would probably use between 200 to 300 kilowatt hours per square meter per annum. Hmm. And so a low-energy building would probably be, the Building Research Establishment UK recommends for a climate in for a building in Chicago to try and reach a target of 100 kilowatt hours per square meter per annum. Now, that's a serious challenge, how to achieve 100 kilowatt hours per square meter per annum. Low-energy design actually starts with the people, the users. And so, you know, if you're prepared to, if you design the interiors of the building to have comfort conditions that's equivalent to ASHRAE standards for the whole year, then you have a high-energy situation. So you have to, you know, if you're prepared to be a little bit cold in winter, a little hotter in summer, or if you wear warmer clothes in winter and walk around starkers in the summer, then you're heading towards a low-energy situation. So it starts with people and the comfort conditions. That's the first thing. So it's not just the realm of the architect and engineers designing low-energy buildings. It has to do with the people, and mm-hmm. people use the building. If they're prepared to have a slightly lower standard of comfort conditions, then you're heading towards a low-energy situation. Next is to try and see what you can do to conserve energy in terms of the built form in a passive sort of way. That means the orientation of the building is important, looking at how the climatic conditions affect the facades of the building, and if we can, without using high-tech facades or high-tech glass, to try and keep the keep out the summer, the sun in the summer, and to let in the summer in the winter. And so these are some of the things that we need to do on the facades. Then the next would be looking at the systems in the building, whether we could try and use systems which lowers the energy consumption. For instance, if you have double switching lighting system, then you know as the day gets darker, then a second tube gets switched on, and so it becomes brighter. Then during the midday and early and late morning, when you don't need that much daylight, when you have a lot of daylight, then you don't need that much artificial light, then the lighting levels could go down. So these are some of the things you could do to reduce, energy consumption buildings.
Mm-hmm. And have you actually built some active kind of active solar, for example, things like that, into your buildings?
Well, I haven't used a lot of active solar systems, but I'm exploring things like light pipes, which are devices that bring daylight into the inner parts of the building without the use of any electrical mechanical systems. And so a light pipe is basically a tube that you can stick on the facade that collects daylight and throws the daylight through a series of reflective surfaces on the inside of the pipe and has a diffuser at the other end that throws daylight back into space. Some of the work that I've done with the universities in Australia, that we've been able to get daylight about 400 lux, 12 meters into the inside of the building. I mean, if you take an average office building, the overhead lighting is probably 300 lux and task lighting about 600 lux. To get 400 lux without the use of electricity, it's quite a good thing to do.
Yeah, it must be a substantial savings when you look at your power bill.
Oh, yes. But, you of course, you know what it means is that you make sure you have daylight outside. I mean, if it's an overcast day.
then you got trouble.
Then you got trouble, yeah.
Another thing that what happens when you get people concentrated in this relatively small footprint is, and I've just been handed some weather information, so I'll put that question on hold, and I want to pass that on to folks, because we have been talking earlier this morning about the fact that there is some potentially severe weather in our area. We want to make sure people know about that. And now we have the National Weather Service in Lincoln issuing a severe thunderstorm warning for northern Macon County in central Illinois. That will be in effect until 11:15 this evening. This morning, the National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a line of severe storms capable of producing penny-sized hail, damaging winds in excess of 60 miles an hour, and that they were located along a line extending from 8 miles north of Warrensburg to Nyantic, or along a line extending from 11 miles southwest of Clinton to 12 miles west of Decatur, and was moving east at 35 miles an hour. And here's a little bit. Maybe it'll be easier to understand what we're talking about if I mention these locations. This involves Warrensburg, Moroa, Harristown, Decatur, Forsyth, Orienta, and Argenta. So do report any severe weather or damage to your local emergency manager, the nearest law enforcement agency, and they'll pass it on to the Weather Service. And, of course, keep it tuned here to AM 580. Again, this is a severe thunderstorm warning for northern Macon County in central Illinois, and that will be in effect until 11:15 this morning. And there is also continuing a warning for southern Logan County in central Illinois and northeastern Sangamon County, and that will be in effect until 10:45. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we're talking with Dr. Ken Yang. He is Distinguished Endowed Plym Professor in Architecture here at the University of Illinois and is also the principal of the architectural firm T.R. Hamza & Yang, based in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. And we're talking about green design in skyscrapers, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What I was thinking about was in addition to a lot of energy consumption in a in a building like this, you also have people and need other things. They need water, so you figure they're probably going to use a lot of water. And then you have a waste issue that comes with concentrating these many people. Right. Now, dealing with that, I suppose, does go back to your earlier comment about the place you start is with the people who live in the building. Obviously, their attitudes towards how they live, towards conservation, for example, is going to be a big first step.
Absolutely.
But then past that, though, as a designer, I'm sure you also have to take that into account.
Yes.
Do you think about those things as well?
Designing a building, there are several aspects to take into account. First, really is to look at it as, I was trained as an ecologist, so I see, ecologists see buildings as potential waste. That means that it's built for a certain use over a period of time, after which, the building has to go somewhere, if we could recycle it as much as we could rather than delivering it to the landfill, that is some of the most important things we need to consider. So one of the areas I'm working on is what I call DFD, which is design for disassembly. So that from day one, you're looking at designing a building that you can reuse and recycle and eventually reintegrate back into the natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
So these are some of the things I'm working on at the moment.
I think that's a very, very interesting concept and something that other designers have started to pay some attention to in the design of – it could be the design of anything. You could be thinking about a car. You're thinking about a computer. Any sort of designed, manufactured device like that you know it's got a limited life, that eventually it's going to break down, it's going to be obsolete. And then the question is, what do you do with it? And I think now that some designers are thinking you should, from the very beginning, you should plan for what you're going to do when that device is no longer useful. You know, how do you recycle it? How do you take it apart? Can you reuse pieces of it? You know, what do you do with it? And I think it's interesting that what you're doing is that you're applying that same sort of way of thinking to a building, the idea being that the building's not going to stand forever. We may want to remodel it. We may want to take it down completely and put something else there. And that's something you need to think about right from the very beginning.
Right. different parts of the buildings have different lifespans, if you like. The facade may be 15 years. The environmental systems, the mechanical electrical systems, maybe about less than 10 years. And the structure may be 30, 40 years. So, you know, you have to think about what happens at the end of their useful performing life. Now, this extends, obviously, the responsibility and liability of the architect. You know, professionally, you know, in most countries, you're only responsible for a building after a limited period of time or 6 years after a particular fault is discovered. Whereas, as an ecological designer, you really should be responsible and think about what happens to the building at the end of its useful life.
Can you give a kind of example? You talk about the facade of the building. It sounds as if of all the parts of the building, that's the thing that's got the shortest life.
Yeah? Well, no, I mean, you know, the interiors have a shorter life. You know,
Okay.
But when you design a tall building, not just the facade, we have to look at it as what I call eco-mimesis, as imitating ecological systems. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at a building like the building you and I in right now, David, everything in this building is inorganic. Yeah. The only thing that's organic is you and me and the bugs. And so, I mean, if you look at things in nature, you know, there's always a balance of the biotic with the abiotic in ecosystems defined as the abiotic constituents and the biotic constituents acting together to form a whole. Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly the sort of thing we should do. We should try and imitate ecosystems because ecosystems have existed in a state of stasis. Our human, made built environment, you know, it's the throughput. You know, things come in and just discharge and goes off somewhere, and we continue doing this, then, you know, the environment will continue to be devastated. And so we need to close the loop. We need to somehow imitate the way, nature builds, how an ecosystem performs and is structured and its processes in nature. For instance, ecosystems have no waste, the waste from one organism becomes food for another. Mm-hmm. And so that's, materials are recycled, within the ecosystem. An ecosystem uses solar energy. So whereas, we still use fossil fuels significantly. And so the more we try and imitate the ecosystem, the more we head towards ecologically successful green architecture. Mm.
Well, that I could imagine that then one of the ways that you do that is the way that you think about your building materials, what it is you're going to build things out of in the first place. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that what your natural inclination is going to be is to do things like build with wood, build with stone, rather than building with plastics or building with... I assume that you have to use metal. You have to have a steel structure for the building. But how does that translate into the way you think about the very basic things that you're going to use to build the building in the first place?
Well, before we start looking at the materials per se, we need to, as I said, balance the inorganic with the organic. Mm-hmm. And so we should try and bring as much organic mass into buildings as possible, almost on a one-to-one or even more higher ratio, so that the building becomes a balanced ecosystem of biotic and abiotic components. So that's one of the reasons why I put a lot of vegetation in my building, and to make them as green as, literally as green as possible, by putting green roofs and green terraces and green facades and so forth. Then the next thing is that, in the selection materials, there are a number of criteria. First criteria really is ease of reuse and recyclability. So and the amount of and the impacts and the consequences of getting that material to the site. And so, there are indexes for this. For instance, if you use aluminum, it has a certain embodied energy value and a certain carbon dioxide emission value. Now, aluminum, for instance, has the highest possible embodied energy material than, let's say, steel. Mm-hmm. But the recycling of aluminum uses maybe one-tenth to, one-quarter the amount of energy that's taken to produce it. Whereas when you recycle steel, you will almost use the same amount of energy that is used to create the steel in the first place. And so every time you recycle aluminum, you virtually half its embodied energy. And so when you select material, it is potential for reuse and recycling, which is just an important factor as where it comes from. Now, wood, for instance, has the potential for reuse, but it is always a downgraded use. You cannot make wood back to its original shape and form again. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, wood starts as starts as a living thing. It's a tree, and once you've chopped down a tree, you've lost a tree. So whereas chunk of aluminium is a chunk of aluminium. So when you recycle it, has no the impact on the environment is on the extracting and delivering the aluminium to the building site. And so the factors in selecting material for a building is ease of reusability and recycling, its embodied energy and carbon dioxide emission index, the consequences of extracting the material from its source to its building site, and then what happens, demolishing it, removing it afterwards at the end of useful life of the building. So these are some of the factors you have to take into consideration in selecting materials for buildings.
Yeah. We are at our midpoint here, and we have a couple of callers, and we will get right to them. Our guest this morning, Dr. Ken Yang. He is a distinguished endowed Plym professor in architecture here at the University of Illinois. He's also the principal in the firm of T.R. Hamza & Yang, based in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, and is internationally known, for specializing in green architecture and applying those principles to large buildings, including skyscrapers. He has written several books on the subject. If you're interested in reading more of his ideas, you can take a look for some of the books, including Designing with Nature. And that was actually, I think, was your dissertation, was an expanded version of your dissertation.
That's right, yes.
For 1995, and another, The Green Skyscraper, and a recent book entitled Eco-Design Instruction Manual that was published in 2005. We have a couple of people here with questions, and we'll get right to them. Belgium, the nearby community, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have to start by saying that designing buildings to be biodegradable, shall we say, reusable, recyclable, in the future is good, but what we really need to think a lot about today is reusing the ones that we are tearing down now and reusing those materials. And as you said, you can reuse some of it, but not all of it, and you thought wood was not very good. They are doing a lot with that now. A lot of beams and stuff are being recycled into flooring and stuff from many East Coast areas and stuff where they use a lot of very large beams. But it seems that we need to worry about the trash we've got on hand now and reusing it as much as worrying about what we're going to do in the future with what we're building now.
Well, there are a couple of issues that you brought up. The first is the idea of reusing existing stock of buildings. That's absolutely important. If we can, we try and recycle our existing stock of buildings and reuse them as much as possible. But sometimes recycling existing buildings may be difficult because the energy consumption, they were not designed for contemporary life. And so, the energy consumption of some of these buildings could be high. And so if you look into the life cycle energy use of a building, the energy consumption in its operational phase could be between 60 to 70% of the energy used in the life cycle of buildings. So, when you look into recycling existing buildings, you have to look into its operational costs as well as the conserving of the material. It might be, on the other hand, much more easier to demolish that building, recycle the existing, the building materials, and put up a much more energy and material efficient building to replace it. Actually, I've got nothing against timber specifically, but I'm just trying to say that, timber we should recycle as much as possible. But every time you recycle timber, it's at a downgraded use because, once you, remove a piece of lumber, you have to, cut off the ends and so forth to recycle it and to make it much more usable. And so, yes, I think we should recycle timber, but we should, be careful what sort of timber that we use, in the first instance, there should be forestry certified timber rather than hardwood timber, which is which takes several hundred years to grow, and that once we remove the tree, remove that a species that's been existing for over 100 years.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Is it difficult in some places to employ some of the design principles that you have because building codes won't let you do it? And do local people who set building codes, is it difficult to persuade them to change the way that they approach the idea of building a building and what it's supposed to be like?
Oh, yes. I mean, the answers and stuff, straightforward as it is. Different states that you have in the U.S. have different building codes. And, some like, Oregon or Portland, has a much more greener approach to building than you would have in other parts of the country. In UK, for instance, the borough of Westminster has over 30 to 40 requirements, sustainable requirements that you should comply before they give you building approvals, planning approvals. And so, the imposition of planning requirements and building requirements varies from country to country, from state to state, and some countries are much more liberal than others.
Hmm. Well, let's talk with another caller here. This is someone in Rankin, line number 2. Hello.
Hi, doctor.
Yeah.
I got the impression that you're referring to the facade and superstructure of the building and its impact on, a global environment. And when people are building tight buildings, we tend to encase ourselves in recycled air. And I wondered if you could speak to the issue of the microenvironment inside the building and if you have any strategies for, people with the chemical sensitivities, outgassing formaldehyde from the carpets, vinyls and plastics indoors, and insulating foams with isocyanates. If there's any alternatives there, any sustainable work there that you have as alternatives for the interiors, and I'll hang up.
Well, this is a fascinating topic, which I've done some research on. The greatest amount of research done on VOCs, so volatile organic compounds, which affects indoor air quality, was done by an American gentleman called Tom Wolverton when he was working for NASA. He concludes that certain species of plants actually absorb volatile organic compounds. He suggested English lily and the bamboo as good examples of plants that absorb volatile organic compounds. And in his studies, he contended that one plant per square meter would significantly help contribute to improving indoor air quality. So that's something that we should try and advance, the use of plants in improving indoor air quality instead of using mechanical means, because plants obviously brings biodiversity into buildings, and whereas if you use mechanical means, it's high energy and it's high technology. And so there again, you have all sorts of related issues and problems that comes with using high technology and high energy. Then the indoor quality obviously depends on the locality that you're talking about. For instance, in certain localities, like in a temperate zone or in a cold climate, like in Chicago or Champaign, you have two very opposing seasons, very hot summer and a cold winter, and then you have two very nice seasons, springtime and autumn. And so spring and autumn, really, you don't need to mechanically ventilate the space if you need to, and you could try and make it as naturally ventilated as possible, in which case then, very nice internal climate, climate conditions, comfort conditions without use of any mechanical electrical systems. But on the other hand, a lot depends on how high you are above the ground. For instance, you're right down the ground level and you're right in the middle of the main street, then, traffic noise and, car vehicle pollution, affects the natural ventilation. So, and then if you go too high up, then, you have high wind speeds, which affects the comfort condition of top living, of the usable spaces. And so so that's, the factor of location, that's the factor of seasons of year, and then that's the issue of what is an acceptable indoor air quality that would be acceptable to the users of the building. So in the same way that comfort conditions can vary as a lifestyle issue with the use of the building, similarly with indoor air quality.
I expect that we are going to see increasing movement towards trying to actually reduce the use of materials that are problematic in the first place. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much people are actually paying attention to those things, but I'm sure that there are some people who are.
There are a lot of interior designers who are aware of this, and so there's a whole list of materials that through off-gassing affects indoor air quality. It's not just materials, it's also equipment, for instance, photocopying machines. Give up particulates which affect indoor air quality, and some perfumes and aftershave lotion that people use also affect indoor air quality as well. So it's not just not just plastics, not just furniture, not just equipment, but also things that people bring in with them when they enter into a space.
Yeah. We're moving into maybe about our last 20 minutes in this part of Focus 580. And again, our guest is Dr. Kenneth Yang. He is Distinguished Endowed Plenum Professor in Architecture at the University of Illinois. He is principal in the firm of T.R. Hamza & Yang, based in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. They also have offices in London and Beijing. He's designed more than a dozen high-rise towers and over 200 projects worldwide, and is well known for specializing in the design of green architecture, particularly this kind of approach to tall buildings, which he calls the bioclimatic skyscraper. He is the author of a couple of books, including Designing with Nature and the Green Skyscraper, if you'd like to read more about his approach to design. And he and his colleagues have won a number of awards for their work. He's spending some time here at the university and was good enough to come over and talk with us this morning. So questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And again, just real quick, let me mention that we are having some strong weather here moving through central Illinois this morning. There is, in fact, a severe thunderstorm watch in effect for all of the WILL severe weather coverage area. That's until 3 o'clock this afternoon, including Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Ford, Iroquois, Livingston, Logan, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, Shelby, and Vermilion counties. And we do also have a severe thunderstorm warning in effect for northern Macon County and central Illinois until 11:15 this morning. We're watching the weather. You keep an eye on the weather, too. And if we have more bulletins, we'll bring them to you. One of the things that we talked about just kind of back at the beginning, where you were talking a little bit about the what the bioclimatic skyscraper is, you mentioned the fact, and I know that one of the things that perhaps sets it apart from other kinds of green design is the attention to the climate, the relationship between the building and the climate. Is this a kind of approach that you can, because I think that a number of the buildings that you have done are located in tropical places. Is this an actual concept that you can bring to a temperate climate? Can you build a building like that in Chicago, for example?
Well, I don't just work in a tropical climate. I work in the UK. We have an office there which is called Llewellyn Davis Yang, which is bigger than our office in Kuala Lumpur. We design buildings in China, we design buildings in Germany, and I've just finished a design for a tower in Portland, Oregon. So, bioclimatic design is really understanding the climate of locality and designing it as a low-energy, passive-mode building that responds to the climate. And so designing the tropics is much easier because you only have one climate generally throughout the whole year, whereas if you design in a temperate climate, then you have winter, summer, spring and autumn. A bioclimatic building, therefore, in a temperate zone responds in different ways depending on the climate of the year. So in the same way, for instance, that at home you would have a different blanket in the summer and a quilt in winter. And so a bioclimatic a building would in the winter be better insulated and much more light in the summer. And then during the mid-seasons, obviously, you need to let the wind in, or you have a much more pleasant climate. So a bioclimatic building could use, for instance, natural ventilation in the mid-season. But designing a bioclimatic building in the temperate zone, what you want to do is to extend the pleasurable seasons of the year, the spring and autumn, as long as possible. So in this way, you move into summer, move into winter, and so you reduce the heating period in summer. And then you reduce the heating period in winter and the air conditioning period in summer, and so in this way, you move to the next mode of design, which is what I call mixed mode, where you use partial electrical and mechanical systems such as ceiling fans, demister fans, and so forth, or evaporative cooling to try and reduce the use of energy during these times of the year.
Okay, let's talk with another caller here, someone in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Yeah. What's the name of the author? I found it interesting when you talked about the use of plants, for outgassing and for internal, inside a house.
His name is Tom Wolverton. I think he's still alive. If you go to Amazon.com, you'll probably find his books there. He's written a couple of very interesting books on how plants can improve indoor air quality. Tom used to work for NASA.
The other one is that, what about, have you done work in terms of the residential housing? It seems to me that houses are pretty much, you know, there's been some improvement in housing, but not a lot. It's, you know, what's your reaction to that in terms of, is there things being done in terms of more environmentally in the, you know, they're built as boxes or whatever, I mean, in terms of the technology?
Well, there are possible things, you know, being done in housing, so we need to look at whether it's high-income, middle-income, or low-income housing. And so what you could do to make a building as green as possible or as low energy, and as low in energy consumption, assuming as possible, is you need to look into how much, what is the budget that we have, you know, available for designing a particular building. And so, you know, for that particular building type, if, you know, industries, if you add maybe 10-15% above industry standard for that particular building type, then you have a little bit more money to try and make the building a little bit more greener than it would be otherwise. And so lots of things being done, use of natural ventilation, use of solar energy, use of renewable sources of energy, improving its natural ventilation opportunities, using variable facades so that you can increase insulation in winter and reduce its and make it as light as possible in summer. Or you design facade systems that let in the sunlight in winter and keep it out in summer. So, you know, there are 1,001 things you could do with residential development.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, and it is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. What about the cost of constructing the building? Is building a bioclimatic skyscraper significantly more expensive than buying a more than building a more conventional kind of building?
Well, everything goes back again to the comfort level. If you accept, you know, slightly lower comfort level than what is industry standard or recommended by the Association of, you know, Engineers, then you know, you obviously could do a great deal with limited budget. Studies have shown that if you take LEED, you know, accreditation as an example, then if, you know, if it's silver, you know, if it's silver accreditation for LEED, I think the building cost is about 10% more, and if it's gold, it's probably about 15% more, and if you hit towards platinum, you know, accreditation probably maybe 20-25% more. But you know, there again, a lot depends on how you use the money. You know, for instance, if you cut down fancy finishes and use cheaper finishes, you can do a lot more things with building. To me, you know, design really, you know, has to do with enhancing the value of the building, and it's almost nothing to do with the cost of material. I mean, if you give me plywood, I could give you a really upmarket facade, you know, for an office building, you know, in New York, for instance, as a matter of design. And mm-hmm. So how you use the material is much more important than the value of the material. So if you have a clever architect, and you have many clever architects around here, and if you, you know, and if you use this material in a clever, in a well-designed way, you can achieve a very nice-looking building, very upmarket-looking, but doesn't have to cost an arm and a leg.
I don't know how many buildings actually are designed by somebody, by architects. I'm sure that there are a lot of buildings that just come from some sort of basic kind of design that somebody has done, and that the number of projects where someone says to an architect like you, "Look, I want you to do this building, and you just give me the best building you can, and You just come back with me when you've got a plan and a model. You go off and you do the thing." It strikes me that probably doesn't happen quite that often.
Occasionally, yes. Well, essentially, when I design a building, I start by establishing three basic models. First model is what I call the client's model, his requirements and the spaces that he needs and what he wants and what he needs, and try and differentiate between the both. And adjacencies between spaces and so forth. So that's the usual, if you like, the design brief. So I call it the first model. The second model is the cost model. You know, there's no such thing as somebody with an unlimited budget, and that I realize the cost is probably most important things in anybody's life. You go to a shop and buy a pair of shoes, having chosen your shoes that you want. The next thing you ask is, how much does it cost? And so in many ways, an architect is managing the money of the client. So, you know, the second model that I have is the cost, you know, budget, whether it is, you know, high, lower, medium, and then you assess where to spend the money. And so, and the third model is what I call the ecological model, so to how green can we make the building, because obviously a totally green building is out of question today because we don't have technology, we don't have the theory, we don't have all the systems to make it totally green. And so design green buildings today, to me, it is a matter of shades of green, if you like, how green can you get? Mm-hmm. And so my third model is the green model. And then once I have these three models in place, then the next is to try and design something that will fit well with each of these models. And so the more successful design is, the better the fit. And so that, to me, is what architectural design is about. Mm-hmm. And so there's no such thing as a limited budget. Everybody has a budget or has this point in which beyond you'll say, well, I'm not going to spend any more money. But I think, to avoid, abortive work and wasted work, it's always good to establish and agree on a budget from day one and try and design to that budget rather than, a budget of design or cost of design.
Yeah. How important is it to you that when you're considering the placement of the building, that you consider the site and particularly whatever amounts to the built environment that exists there? Is it possible to integrate a building like this into a place where there are other buildings that are just not like that?
Well, yes, you have to. That's the cultural and stylistic aspect of integrating with locality. But if you go back to what I said earlier on at the start of this interview, to me, a green building is one that integrates with its natural environment in a seamless, benign way. Mm-hmm. And to integrate, to me, is at three levels: physically, systemically, and temporally. Physically means integrating with the ecology of location and the physical characteristics of location. So you have to look at the topography, its ecology, its hydrology, its geology, and so forth. And you have to map all these before you start to plonk the building on the site. And so that whatever you put on the site will not irreversibly affect the ecology of the site. So that's the first thing you need to do as an ecologist. But obviously, socially and in town planning terms, There could be existing buildings and other things on the site, like existing roads, infrastructure, drains, utilities, and other uses which may affect the shaping and the configuration of your building. So these are some of the things you need to account, not just in plan, but also in section as well, and in aesthetics as well. So so architecture really isn't, it's not something that we can just do it over a couple of days. It's not something that has to be crafted. Mm-hmm. So that's why it makes it such a difficult and stressful profession.
Yeah. Well, in some of the urban environments that you've worked, are you coming into a place that essentially is a concrete jungle? It's flat. It's surrounded by walkways and by roadways, and there's not a lot of existing green space. I mean, have you had to go into places like that?
Well, absolutely. In some ways, the great British architect Norman Foster says, a work of architecture as well designed can change locality. You can create new public realm, you can create relationships with the street, relationship with the block, and relationship with the city. So, you could actually do an immense number of things that can actually contribute to the locality regardless of where you're in or whatever's been built there or in existence before you put your building there.
What sort of size constraints do you face? I mean, is there? We were talking about green skyscrapers, but are you thinking? Is there a certain optimal size beyond which you really can't go?
Size. Well, actually, size of the locker room things. Who's bigger than New York? But I mean, the Council of Tall Buildings in Chicago contend that a building over 60 stories becomes uneconomically viable. So when you put up a building over 60 stories, then it's either for some other mitigating reasons besides the economic viability of the building or the economic viability of the structure and the systems. And so 60 stories seems to be about the limit.
Uh-huh. Well, do you think is there unhealthy competition among designers and builders for size? Is there still, obviously there is, because we continue to see people building buildings taller than other structures. So it sounds like at least some people do have this thing about wanting to build a taller building than the guy down the street or whoever is in the next city or wherever it is that the current tallest structure is.
Well, human beings are competitive people, so there will always be instances where you want to be richer than the next man, holier than the next man, and bigger than the next man, or whatever, or better looking than the next person. So it's human nature, really.
Skyscrapers that you said a little bit earlier, you think this is just not, it's not a kind of a thing that's going to go away. The ones that we have aren't going to go away, and because we have the need to, because of the growth in urban areas and we're expecting continued growth, we're going to have places for people to live and to work and to do all their activities. And that seems to make the, it's the best use of space in a sense, because the land is valuable and that allows you to put a lot of people and activities on a relatively small footprint by going up. Do you, though, see over a longer term some kind of alternative? I mean, is the urban environment always going to be like that? We're always going to have to be building up like that?
Oh, no. I think what we really need is a new model for life, because we cannot continue the way that we're doing now, a profligate way of lifestyle and you know, the food that we eat and, I mean, some transportation and, you know, we really need a new ecological model for existence. And now, it's very sad, you know, to me that, you know, I don't see people taking, you know, that into consideration. I see local authorities obviously beginning to do some effort towards sustainable living and sustainable construction. But at the end of the day, something will force us to do this, a major catastrophe or something like that. And then people will say, oh, right, you know, we better do something, otherwise, you know, we'll lose. This will be the last millennium for us, you know, and that after this, there won't be any others. And so, the sooner we recognize this, and whether by intent or by default or by something happening through climate change or whatever, then we will begin to look into maybe we should have a more ecological lifestyle, ecological way of looking at urban growth. Ecological approach, you're looking at economic growth and the way we manage our environment, the way we manage our systems, the way we manage our cities. And then when that happens, then there will be a total change in our built environment.
But it's just, though, if you're looking at what is most efficient in terms of energy use particularly, that does seem to argue for concentrations of people.
Well, the argument is for better use of land. Sometimes, you know, intensification of high-rise buildings are not, you know, away from transportation hubs is actually not a particularly good thing to do. And so if you were to, you know, intensify development of being high-rise, we should put them as close as possible to transportation hubs so that this would reduce the energy cost of consumption. And that's, you know, sometimes intensifying people on a particular location could improve its efficiency and energy use.
Well, we're going to have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time. I want to thank again our guest, Dr. Ken Yang. He is Distinguished Endowed Plym Professor in Architecture here at the University of Illinois in the School of Architecture. He's also principal in the firm of T.R. Hamza & Yang based in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.